In continuing our general topics in Bava Metzia, and specifically the last few shirim before Chanukah, and then we got the Chanukah issues, and then last week because of Sar B'tevet, so Rav Oron gave a shiur dedicated to specifically to Sar B'tevet. We decided that would be the best, if you will, the best topic for Asar HaTevet itself. But at the same time, I also wanted to connect to Asar HaTevet, the Yom HaKadish HaKlali, and to actually discuss a sugya, really not a sugya, a major issue, which unfortunately has became an issue over the course of the aftermath of the Shoah, and continues to reverberate to this day. The question of property that was confiscated during the war, and this really touches very much directly on the sugyot that we've been learning throughout the year, throughout the parash, and how it impacts directly. For me personally, I'll tell you, it's a personal issue still. My own family is in the midst of a protracted legal struggle to get some kind of either restitution or restitution or at least compensation for property that was taken from my family more than, at this point, about 75 years ago in Croatia. These are things that continue to, if you keep an eye on newspaper headlines, you'll see these are issues that continue to pop up. But by the way, I have to tell you, I'm not going to get into this right in here, but it can be in the reverse as well. Here we're talking about it in terms of a brutal military takeover, the Nazi conquest. But if you talk about the questions of legitimacy and what to do with property, if you take a look post-Kim, even in 1949, we're dealing with questions of how to look at abandoned Arab property in the pre-67 borders. Should halacha view those abandoned homes and fields? That's something which there's a tshuva of Tzvi Pesach Frank, for example, asking on the Pesach of 1949 whether lettuce taken from abandoned Arab fields would be considered to be marur hagazul. Would it be stolen maror if you were to use that lettuce on Leil HaSeder? So there are so it goes in all directions when you're talking about confiscation of property, and the question is, what happens to it? Do the original owners have any legal rights to it? And obviously, this has ramifications not only in halacha, it has ramifications in international law as well. And the international law has an impact, we'll mention this later, on the halacha as well, but we'll leave that towards the end of the shir. What I wanted to do, just to frame the shir, was to take a particular tshuva, not even a tshuva, the summary of the legal proceedings of a particular case in 1953 that was raised in front of and you can see the Dayanim here in source number one, were Gedolei Olam, Rav Yaakov Adas, who was the Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshiva Parat Yosef, Rav Shalom Eliashiv, Rav Bitzal Zolti, who was the Rav of Yerushalayim. And this was the question that came to them. Basically, there had been a person who had from the town of Makov in Hungary. And there was a family Sefer Torah, and without getting into the details, I brought the details here if you want to take a look at it, but basically the keter of that, the silver crown for that Sefer Torah, was stored separately from the Sefer Torah itself. At some point during the I don't remember if the exact year was mentioned in the Tshuva, at some point in the war, we'll say 1944, when the Nazis were came into Hungary, so the Torah crown was confiscated. Much of property that Judaica and the like, which was more or less ownerless after the war, so it was when the Allied forces came in, they handed it over to various Jewish organizations for distribution. The organizations generally held on to whether it was Sifrei Torah, whether it was the ornaments of the Sifrei Torah, held on to them for a couple of years with the hope that the original owners would come forward. At a certain point, when the owners did not come forward, then they distributed the Sifrei Torah, distributed whatever other implements that they had to different shuls, different organizations, institutions, and the like. In this particular case, this fellow had been had made his way from Hungary after the war to Israel. He lived in Haifa. He came to Yerushalayim on a visit. At the time, it was before 1967, so the Old City was not in our hands at that point. The closest that you could get to the Old City was on Har Tzion, immediately outside of Shar Tzion, and in an area which to this day is called Kever David. It was much more, you can go there today as well, but it was a much more popular pilgrimage stop, if you will, because it was as close as you could get to the Ir Atika as possible. There's a Bet Knesset there. And this fellow went on a trip to Yerushalayim. He came to the Bet Knesset at Kever David of Har Tzion. And he sees, lo and behold, his family keter on the Sefer Torah. He is able to identify it. It was also, the names of family members were engraved in it. It wasn't any question that it belonged to him. He was able to bring witnesses to discuss who also had survived, who were able to describe exactly how the Sefer Torah or the Keter had been confiscated by the Hungarian Nazi party. And so he wanted to have that Keter returned to him and to his family immediately, to bring it back to he had saved the Sefer Torah that was the match, and he wanted to reunite the Keter. Even so, called it Lahachzir Atara LeYoshna, to return the crown to its original glory, quite literally. And the organization, I don't know who ran Kever David at that point, but they didn't disagree with the details, and they didn't disagree that this Keter had come to them and was most likely, if not definitely, had been owned by this person before the war or during the war. But they said, well, now it's ours. You know, we understand that, and we feel your pain, as it were. But it is ours, and they quoted the Gemara that we'll talk about in a moment, Zuto Shel Yam. They said this is an equivalent of Zuto Shel Yam, the tides of the waves of the Nazi conquest are no less, but even greater than the physical tsunami. That tsunami swept away all of European Jewry. And so the this particular crown of a Sefer Torah was just the, if you will, the Derinus that had been able to find its way to the shores of Eretz Yisrael. And so that is, in effect, a Zutel Shel Yam situation. They were willing to allow the person to take the crown back, but they wanted compensation from him for their troubles in terms of having gotten the crown. They wanted, at the time, 50 Israeli lirot, which I don't know what it was worth in 1954. I could have Googled it. I didn't look, to be honest with you. In 1948, I will just tell you that the Israeli pound, the lira, which there are 10,000 Israeli lirot to every new shekel, just to put it into into perspective, right? Every time you hold one shekel coin, that's holding 10,000 lirot. So if you thought that the rand was bad, so, you know, then, you know, just to tie it to the lira. However, when the state was founded, it was pegged to the British pound. So at the time, in 1948 at least, for a brief shining moment, the Israeli pound was worth $5. Okay, so when they were asking for 50 pounds, so it was was, okay, we'll say it was four or five, we'll say 250 US dollars at that time, take into account inflation. So you're talking about something that in our today's dollars would be worth, I don't know, roughly speaking, somewhere between $1,000 and $1,500. Something along those lines, maybe a little bit more even. So that was, so it was a large sum of cash, especially for a person who was a refugee. And that's what they said. They said, if you give us this amount of money, we'll give you the keter, otherwise it's ours. Okay, and then this comes to Beit Din. What? This is the organization that was running Kever David. The Gabbai, etc. This is their claim. They say this is now belongs to the Kever David Synagogue, and if you want it, we'll sell it to you.
Okay? They bought it?
They didn't buy it. Apparently, they were. It seems as though from the continuation of the Psak, let's give it at the end. It seems as though they were an organization that was given property that was ownerless. From the joint, and they claimed that they had various expenses in terms of that needed to be covered, and that's why they were asking for this sum of cash. So that was that's the case, and that's what is presented to the Dayanim. So in order to understand this, really there are three areas of halakha that we have to talk about. One is, the next few makorot, I just gave you pieces of Gemara that we have learned together over the course of the year. So the Gemara, one of them is the case where which should apply. Amar Rav Papa, excuse me, the last line on Chaf Aleph Amud Bet, Tashema Haganav Shenatal Mizeh V'Natan Lezeh, V'chein Gazan Shenatal Mizeh V'Natan Lezeh, V'chein Yarden Shenatal Mizeh V'Natan Lezeh. I'll just tell you that there is a girsa in the Tosefta where this comes from, that it's not Yarden, right, not the River Jordan, but Rodan. Okay, Rodan is a dictator, right? Meaning, so, which, in terms of the context, works better, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily the correct girsa. Sometimes in looking at different nuscha'ot, the more difficult nusach is considered to be at face value, generally more likely to be the correct one, without getting into why right now. But the point, though, is that it could be that it was a very similar situation. So the be that as it may, mashenatal natal or mashenatal natal. So what was taken, what was given, meaning that there's a new situation here. And you have to follow that new situation. However, the Gemara says, that it seems to be tied to Yeush. Vishlam a gazlan v'yardein dekachazi lahu umiyayesh. Right? I see it. I know it's been confiscated from me, either by human hands or by natural disaster, and I am miyayesh. Right? But what about a ganav? And the Gemara answers that this is also a form of gazlan. And ganav here means that it's a type of gazlan who's hiding his identity. Right? It's the guy who walks into the bank with a stocking over his face. But basically, that is also a form of gazlan, right? But it's called a ganav here because his identity is unknown. Whereas the gazlan, where the other case is where we know exactly who it was, and he doesn't really care that we know who he was. He has no fear whatsoever. Okay, so whether that's a good reading of ganav or not, right, that you probably dealt with when you learned the sugya, had a lengthy discussion with it with Sam, if he recalls, and about that. So the but that's with regard to ganav. But with regard to gazlan, and in terms of the thrust of the Gemara, it seems pretty clear that it's dependent upon yeush. And if there was yeush, so then indeed mashenatan natan. If there wasn't yeush, whatever the reason, so then we can assume then that the person is not necessarily hasn't given up on this. There's another case, and the other case, which is it's brought several places in the Gemara, but is what's known as zutel shel yam. And there, the way that it's rendered on Chav Bet Amud Bet, the Gemara calls it, as opposed to a normal Avedah here, it's, to use the terminology, it's on line 13 or so, Mishe Avuda Hemenu Umitsuya Etzel Kol Adam, Yatzata Zo, She Avuda Mimena Ve'ena Mitsuya Etzel Kol Adam. The difference between a case of Zuto Shel Yam and the normal situation is if I lose something, so then it's in human society. If on the other hand, and so therefore maybe I'll be able to get it back. In Zuto Shel Yam, it's been swept away. It's Eina Mitsuya Bidei Adam. It's not found by, it's an unrealistic expectation to ever be able to find it. And so therefore the normal halachot of Hashavat Aveda do not apply. Now, the question is that's raised by the Rishonim, or implied by the Rishonim, does that mean that you don't need Yeush at all? What if a person says, oh, I know that I lost something at sea, but I'm going to get it back. I'm going to figure out a way. I'm going to hire a salvage crew. We're going to get that ship. We're going to get the Titanic. Okay? Doesn't matter. So is that still something which is that we will say it's Eina Mitsuya Etzel Kol Adam? The Gemara on Chaf Dalid, so the Gemara lumps it together with other cases. In the middle of the Amud there, HaMatzil Min Ha'ari Min Adob Min Ha'mer Min Ha'bardeles, if you save something from various wild animals, minzuto shel yam, mishluyato shel nahar, and then after bringing those cases where one could assume that under normal circumstances they are lost, and the other person now takes it, so it's his, the Gemara says. But then it says, hamotze bisratya uplatya gdola, if you find something in a large public square, because the owners, the original owners, have given up Yeush. And the Rambam understands this to apply to all of the cases. All of the cases of Zuto Shel Yam require Yeush. It's just that certain circumstances, the Yeush is a given. Mipnei shehabalim mityaashim. But the Rambam says, if you have evidence that the Baalim were not mityaashim, so then Zutel Shel Yam is no different than any other Aveda. It's just different because, normally speaking, we assume there is no Yeush, unless proven otherwise. And that's all of the sugyot that we've been doing throughout the year. But under certain circumstances, we assume Yeush, unless proven that there wasn't Yeush. So Zutel Shel Yam is one of those situations. But you would require Yeush, it's just that it's usually assumed, and if you, for whatever the reason, you can show that there wasn't Yeush, so then that wouldn't necessarily apply. So here the other Rishonim, though, disagreeing, the Ravid right away on that particular Rambam, this was source number 5, the Ravid says, quoting the Rambam, he says, Amar Avram Elu Divrei Teimahem. These are, you know, just very puzzling things that the Rambam says. The Ravid is only hinting to it, but other Rishonim say it explicitly, that you have to distinguish between the cases, that if you're talking about the case of the Zuto Shel Yam, if you're talking about the Ari, the Dove, etc., there you don't need Yeush at all. That's Eina Mitzuya Eitzala Kol Adam. That does it. That's an exception to the basic rule of Aveda. There is no chiyuv of Hashavat Aveda under those circumstances. Stratio and Platio, that's the case, Mipnei Shabal and Mityashin. In a place with a lot of public traffic, there we can assume there's Yeush, Mipnei Shabal and Mityashin, but if you can show that there wasn't Yeush, then that's perhaps the discussion of the Gemara Daf Kaddish, which I'm not going to get into right now, in terms of the cases of the various rivers and the like, and the dams, that, under those circumstances, that requires Yeush. But in the first half of the Braita, it doesn't require Yeush at all. And even if the Baalim are screaming, I am not Mityaesh, we don't listen, we don't care. The finder doesn't have to start looking for that Baal. Maybe this is his, not his. He can take it for himself. So the question then becomes, right, whether or not in the case of the something along the lines of the Shoah, was there Yeush or not? Now I'll add one other level of one other thing to be included here. And while it doesn't exactly apply to the case of the Keter, it does apply to a lot of the other instances of confiscated property, or one specific instance. And that was the question of books that are confiscated. Because when it comes to books, there are many Rishonim based on their understanding of the Gemara and Baba Kama. Because, one other thing to add, we include Ganav and Gazlan, right, and we're treating it the same as Aveda. When I lose something, I lost something. When I have a Ganav, a Gazlan, an Ari, and a Dove, so these are things that are taken away from me. Right, and I know that they're taken away from me, and I am mityaesh about them. It's not simply that I have lost it, I don't know where I put it. Right. This is a case where there has been geneva, and in geneva too, we say that the object indeed transfers ownership legally. There is a legal obligation on the part of the thief to return it, and we can make him return it. And there are a lot of halachot in Baba Kama. I'm not going to get into right now what the obligation is, but we understand that from a property perspective, ownership has transferred to the gazlan, especially or perhaps only in the case when there is yeush on the part of the owner as to having being able to find it again. Though he has the right to claim it. And one of the instances that the Gemara in Baba Kama talks about is if you have an object that was stolen and it was pawned, and then another person purchases it, and the original owner claims title to it. So the Mishnah says that under those circumstances, what do you have to do? Nope. That was the seventh source. You, who has to take a shavua?
The owner.
The original owner?
Yeah.
No.
No, the finder.
The, the purchaser. In other words, I can first, the owner has to prove that indeed he did not, he didn't sell it, and that really was his. Okay? Which, okay, however he does that. Then the purchaser, who's an innocent victim, right? I went, and I went to, and there's, and the halacha deals with situations as well, but not necessarily the same, if I purchase it when I'm well aware that it's most likely stolen merchandise. Then we're not as forgiving of the for the purchaser. But here it's an innocent, it was an innocent situation. I purchased something. I had no idea that it was stolen. Okay? So now I have to take a shavua that I didn't know and that it was a and this is how much I spent. And then the person has to compensate me. In other words, you want your stolen object back, fine. You have the right to it, but you have to pay for it. It's not that I shouldn't take the loss. I'm not the thief. I might not have even bought it from the thief. I might have bought it, you know, three steps away. It's been pawned several times along the way. Now you find it 5 years later. So who knows how many people it's passed their hands through. But it doesn't matter. Right? There is this notion of returning the lost property, the stolen property, but at a price. So now the, however, the Tosfot says that there is an exception. Without getting to why Tosfot says it, there's an exception to this rule, and that's if we're dealing with Sifrei Kodesh. We're talking about Sifrei Kodesh that have been confiscated. So then, there isn't necessarily Yeush, Tosfot says. Everything that we've said now assumes that there was Yeush. I gave it up, it's not mine, and now it is in your possession. So now I have to purchase it from you. I have the right to purchase it, but it still needs to be purchased. But let's say I didn't have Yeush, and I can prove that I didn't have Yeush. Why would I not have Yeush about Sfarim? Why more simanim there than other things?
Because you wrote it yourself.
Maybe. But let's say I didn't. Let's say, you know, I'm not a scribe.
Writing style, parchment, size.
So it's a better siman, but I can have, let's say, if my name is engraved in my silver kiddush cup. Right? It's also a pretty good siman. Why is this svarim not have yeush?
Really expensive.
Because the answer is that the Sfarim, the only market for them is a religious Jewish market. In other words, who's going to be purchasing a Sefer Torah? Who's going to be purchasing a rare manuscript or a, just a, you know, remember, they didn't necessarily have rare manuscripts. They just had manuscripts. Who's going to be purchasing the Rambam so that they can learn it, right? Another Jew. So I'm not mitya'esh because I assume that some other Jew's going to get it, then I'll be able to give the siman. But if I'm talking about a silver cup, let's say, so that silver cup can end up in anyone's hand. It might get melted down. I don't have any expectation or reasonable expectation that I'll ever see it again. So I'm mitya'esh when it comes to svarim, so that might not be the case. And as a result, the Rama paskins in number 9 that yesh omrim di mavad svarim lo miyayish minayu afilu b'makom sheruba oved kochavim. Right, that if something is lost or taken, I can assume that the I can try to get it back, and they can't assume yesh. Yeah.
Did they not have museums back then?
They didn't necessarily have museums.
Or like just people who would collect rare.
Who's back then? When do you...
Either Tosfos...
No, they didn't have museums.
Or like just people who collect things.
They weren't necessarily collectors. Right, they didn't have that, for the most part. Certainly not for books. In other words, it could be that if it was a beautiful... If you go to different museums today, you'll see beautiful examples of illustrated books from the medieval period, And they were obviously more expensive than your, you know, just somebody who had written down the text of the Gemara Bava Metzia. Okay? Those, there were books that were more decorative, in the same way that you have now. I wouldn't quite call them coffee table books, but they were books that people would be proud to have on their shelves, and very wealthy people would have. And then, by the way, this is not only in the Jewish world. In the you have those kind of manuscripts both in the Muslim world and the Christian world as well. But the and then there were books that were used by people. They weren't being used to necessarily to show off. There could be books that were written for communal use. So some of the most expensive manuscripts that exist now are very large sidurim. Actually, one of the cases that dealt with this in the Sotheby's case, which was a similar type of situation. In the Sotheby's case, in the 1980s, there were a couple of rare manuscripts that had been that were were owned by the library of the Reform Movement in Berlin, and one of the faculty members, when he escaped in 1938 or 39, so he had taken two of those volumes with him. He claimed that they were given to him for safekeeping, and he was told that because of the tremendous risk that was involved, if he had been caught, he would have been executed, that they were given to him as a gift, but that this was the idea that it was going to be saved this way. They surfaced in the 1980s. He decided to sell them at that point, and there was a whole legal proceedings about whether he had the right to do it, and the halakha question came up as well. So one of those manuscripts, this was actually, they settled out of court in the end, because the U.S., the New York District Attorney tried to stop the sale. Because he said from New York law, this was stolen merchandise that shouldn't be considered private property. They came to an out-of-court settlement and went to different museums, and I think that you can, if I'm not mistaken, you can view it. It's on display in the National Library here now. It's a siddur that was written for the use of the of a shliach tzibur, and had, you know, again, it was only used on chagim, and it was something which was cherished by the community. So you have different kinds of manuscripts, but it wasn't in a museum collection the way that we would have today. Because all the books were manuscripts. It wasn't something which, in that sense, was special. But books as a whole were much more expensive than our books. Right? Certainly, because they were labor-intensive. The materials themselves were very expensive, relatively speaking. The a book, you know, would be worth, you know, perhaps even 100 times what, but certainly tens of times more than what we think of the value of a book. So that's based on this. You can make differentiate. You know, you could say something along the lines of this Torah crown, right? Because if the Nazis had held on to it. So, what were they going to do with it?
Melt it down.
Either melt it down or
keep it.
Most likely, melt it down or keep it. What would the Nazis do with a silver crown?
Were they planning on making a museum of like?
So, in Prague, there are. If you visit Prague, it's not totally clear. There are those who claim that this is not true, but it seems to be, just based on the amount, they certainly used Prague as a storehouse, and they cataloged. And there are, to this day, there are hundreds, not thousands, of specimens of these type of objects. And you can go to the, it's housed in one of the shuls in the Jewish quarter of Prague, which is no longer functioning. It's been turned into a museum, and one of the so there was a project at least a rumored project and possibly a real project of the Nazis to create a museum to the culture of the destroyed Jewish race. And that was going to be housed in Prague. And in any event, a great many clay kodesh were found there after the war, as well as other properties. So the question then becomes, okay, is there Yeush, is there not Yeush under those circumstances? In other words, were people thinking the war will end and, you know, there will be survivors and there will be ways to find the this property. Right, the war will end and ultimately the Allies will prevail. Or were people just saying, no, there's no sense whatsoever. It's a zuto shel yam situation, right? You can't expect anything under these circumstances. So there was those who said, this is after the war, so I brought you one of them, a Rav Yitzchak Isaac Leibus, who was a Av Beit Din in the Ukraine when the war broke out, and he lost his entire family. He married a survivor of another family, the sole survivor of that family, of his Rebbe's family, and they emigrated to the States, and he became a Rav in New York. And he wrote a tshuva. He has a set of Shalat Tshuva called Beit Avi, and he in his tshuva, where he was dealing with this, he said the whole ruling of the Rama is totally irrelevant in the Shoah. So there was no such thing as no Yeush in the Shoah. Everything was since there had been no calamity that befall the Jewish people as great as the Shoah. So everyone in the Shoah just assumed that they were being taken out, they were going to be killed. And if they were going to be killed, certainly their property was going to be confiscated and never to be seen again. You might be able to differentiate, and there are those who do differentiate and argue with him and say, well, it really depends on the circumstances. It depends on the community. It depends on what was going on. Is this property, was it property that had been confiscated? Was it property that, and let's say legally confiscated? For example, in the case of my family, we found the records, we have the records of an exact detail of the property that was sold to the Croatian authorities at the time. And so we have there's a log. In other instances, Rav Kleiman was telling me how he remembered as a boy, so when the Nazis came into his town and they had them cut down all of the metal fencing, all of the metal shutters, anything of value that could be used for the war effort was taken away. That's just scrap metal, right? As well as silver and gold. And his father buried the candlesticks in their backyard. And he never went back. You know, to the best of his knowledge, they're still there. And so but would that have the same halacha of Yeush? In other words, after the war, if I had hidden something and then someone else discovered it, so maybe that's different because there's no Yeush. But if on the other hand, I'm looking at the Zutel Shel Yam and I'm saying this is something which is overwhelming, it doesn't matter whether you had Yeush or not. But so this is the issue that comes up amongst the poskim, whether you require Yeush or not. But there's another aspect which you did not learn. I don't know if you, hopefully you reached the second half of the sheet. You get that to this point? To the table here? And the second, on the flip side? So this is a Gemara, I just took snippets of the Gemara in Kikin. And the Gemara deals with the following situation. Eved shenishba ufida'ohu. Im l'shum eved yishtabed, im l'shum ben chorin lo yishtabed. So if you have an eved kina'ani owned by a Jew, and he's captured by a non-Jew, and another Jew redeems him, so is their ownership been transferred? buy that. It was the first owner lost it because he lost his slave because the slave had been captured by the enemy troops. And now I purchase it from purchase him from the enemy troops. So is it my slave or not? So the Mishnah says, well, it depends on how you were redeeming it. If he was redeeming it to be a slave, in other words, I bought him on the slave market with the intention of him serving me as my slave, so then he continues to be my slave. And if I wanted to redeem him as a Jew, because a Eved Kanani is a, if you will, a second-class Jew, and the moment that he's freed, he becomes a full-fledged Jew. So if I see this person, I know him, he's a slave, and he's but he's always been keeping Shabbat and been keeping kosher, because that's what Eved Kanani has to do. And now I'm going to redeem him on the slave market, and in order to set him free, so he becomes free. That's the Mishnah. Now the Gemara has a long discussion on this, and the Gemara wants to know, asks a very basic question, right? This is from the Mishnah, it seems, is that I can, that the ownership, if you will, of the middleman, of the guy who had captured this slave, was legitimate, because after all, I'm buying it from him. I'm buying the slave from him. I'm buying it treating it the way slaves are as property. So if that's the case, right? How do I even know that this works? Well, as I said, it's very basic. What gives? Where in the Torah do you see that you have the ability to have this kind of transfer without legal transfer? And also, where do you see in the Torah that you have this ability, that someone has the ability to own another person? You talk about avadim, but where are the... how does that work exactly? It's one thing if a person sells himself, maybe, but when someone is captured and sold into slavery, where's the legitimacy of it? And the Gemara says something which is... The Gemara brings different psukim to prove it. However, the Gemara then says the following. This is the third line there. Perhaps the only time that you can sell it is where the sale works is hani mili b'kasva v'chazaka lo amar lo. Excuse me. Amar Rav Papa amon umoav tiharu v'sicham. So Rav Papa says I can prove it. The in Sefer Bamidbar, Amon and Moab are captured. Areas of Ammon and Moab are captured by Sichon. The halacha is that the Torah tells us that you cannot take the property of Ammon and Moab. We could not capture Ammon and Moab when we came in. Specifically, that these are Bnei Avram. We're not allowed to touch their property. You can look in the end of Sefer Bamidbar as to why. So, however, Sichon was an Emori. He had captured areas that belonged to Ammon and Moab. We were able to take it from him, and that becomes the Yerusha on the other side of the Yarden for the 2.5 tribes. So, how did that happen? So Rav Papa says, by virtue of the fact that Sichon captured it, so then it no longer was considered Ammonite territory, wasn't considered Moabite territory, it is Sichon's territory now, and we captured it from Sichon. So, the Gemara says this applies even if a non-Jew, applies if a non-Jew takes it from another non-Jew, it also applies if a non-Jew takes it from a Jew, and it brings a pasuk, Vayish Mimenu Shevi, that the Torah says that the Kna'anim took captives from the Jewish people, which the Gemara understands as meaning they had legal right to those captives. The Gemara here is basically saying that there is a new kinyan. This kinyan is called, in different terms, we'll call it kinyan kibush, kinyan of conquest. In other words, war is legal. Now, there are boundaries to what that legality is, but war is a legal construct, war between nations. And part of war is the capture of territory. Part of the war is capture of property and the confiscation of property. And the Gemara says that is legal and binding. So here in this circumstance, you could say that the, as difficult as it is for me to say, is that the Nazi conquest was, from a perspective of conquest, a legal conquest. There was a war, and boundaries change, property is confiscated, same way that the Allies, when they were victorious, so there was property that was taken from the Germans, boundaries were redrawn, and areas that had been part of Germany before the war became now part of other countries, or new countries were formed. And all of that is legally binding. So, by the same token, the Nazi conquest, the Nazi confiscation, is legally binding, and it's no longer the personal property of the individual. Now here, there's a machlok at how that works. Rashi on the Gemara says that it's basically that there's yeyush. Why is this the case? Because this isn't a new kinyan. This is just a form of a regular kinyan of chazakah. This has been taken away and the person is mityayesh. He doesn't expect ever to see it again. That's Rashi's understanding. However, the Rashba and others say that no, there is a real kinyan without yeyush. Just simply by virtue of the fact that there is this conquest. And the Rashba says that this is what the Gemara talks about when it talks about kaspa kesef on the one hand and chazakah on the other. Kesef means things that there is a normal kinyan. Normal kinyan means that I give you a purchase price. You intend to give me the object, and there's a transfer. Then there's another type of kinyan called chazakah. Chazakah means by force of arms, and that doesn't require the dat, doesn't require the acknowledgement of the person who is losing the property. That is now the rightful property of the conqueror. Here, having said that, so then all of the, if that's the case, then all of the discussion that we've been talking about until now would no longer apply. Of course, this may be a, there, I didn't bring this source here, but there are those who say that it's only temporary. This temporary conquest is until the next conquest. In other words, the in our situation, if the Allies now have, and this is the, would make perfect sense, the Allies now create, or the international community creates a legal system which deals with stolen property. And now had the law becomes that that property doesn't become the property of the American government. I mean, we all know that, let's say, the Aron Kodesh, right, is in a warehouse in Washington. Right?
Vatican,
we saw that. What?
That was the Vatican.
Right? What?
That was the Vatican.
No, you were obviously, you must have only seen Indiana Jones starting the second episode. But the we understand that. But for the most part, most of the property that was transferred, there are, each country, and this is my own personal struggle against the Croatians, each country has its own law as to how to deal with property that was confiscated during the war. Okay, and then there are certain international agreements that that exist. But all of that is basically legal because it's now a new conqueror. Right? The Nazis had their law. Right? The Soviets had theirs. The Americans and the British had theirs, and the different zones had different laws. And then if this property happens to fall within the laws of, let's say, that demand the return of the stolen property, so then it becomes mine, but not because I held on to it and it was always mine, but now the new conqueror makes that determination and is returning it to that to the original owners, if you will. But it's a return. Now, hold on, because it's already getting very close to Mincha. I'll take questions afterwards. There are those who make, and this is the psak here, A very interesting distinction. The Rambam, just to show you, which might be a source that predates it. I'll tell you two halachas of the Rambam. One is that's not here. Well, yeah, I don't have time to get to the one that's not here. I'll just say that it might actually impact on the Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael. And those of you who are familiar with the Rambam in terms of Hilchot Kedusha of Eretz Yisrael can understand why Kitcha, the Kedusha Rishona, Kitcha Lashata, the Lo Kitcha La'atid Lavo, but might be the same halacha here. But the Rambam makes a distinction. He has the following case. Apparently there were also Sifrei Torah, Sifrei Kodesh, that were looted, and the original owners want them. And the Rambam was asked in the tshuva, do they belong to the original owners or not? And he makes the following distinction. He says, if it was a government activity that took them away, it was the Sultan who had sent these pirates, so then they're gone. And the original owners have no right to them. But if it was a roving band of pirates, right? It was Pirates of the Caribbean. So then the original owners can stake claim to that. What's the difference? It's conquest. It's taken away. What's the difference? So the one possible answer, and this was what the Dayanim said in the original case, they made the following distinction, very interesting distinction. They said that the original case that we're talking about, the crown of that sacred Torah, was confiscated not by German Nazis, but by Hungarian, I guess the Black Arrow, the equivalent of the Nazis, the fascists of the Hungarian party. They said that makes all the difference in the world. This is a tremendous chiddush on their part, but it makes a lot of sense. They said this law of conquest is only valid if it's a foreign power, the boundaries have changed, if a government changes. So then the new government has the right to make the new laws. But if let's say right now, in this case it was the Hungarian Black Arrow. It could have been today what's going on in the streets of Tehran. If you have a government which is terrorizing its own population, so then that doesn't have the law of conquest. They are just a government with perhaps illegal illegal laws. There isn't any. They are thieves and robbers and pirates with a different name. Just happens to be that they are seated in power at the moment, but that doesn't give legitimacy to their confiscation. That's the argument of the Dayanim in this particular case. So they said that had it been, very interesting, they said had it been German Nazis in Hungary coming in, and because of the new government that's being formed, that was confiscated by the Germans, so then that would perhaps be a kinyan of conquest. But if you're talking about an internal dictate, so that doesn't have that status. That might have a status of Dina de Malchuta Dina, which we're not getting into right now. But Dina de Malchuta Dina has one major limitation. Dina de Malchuta Dina is considered legitimate by Jewish law only when it's a fair law. Whereas by fair, it doesn't mean necessarily that we couldn't, like a democratic law. By fair, it means that it's being it's being legislated and being applied universally. If it's a discriminatory law, as obviously the confiscation of Jewish property was, if it's a discriminatory law, so then it doesn't have the binding legal halachic force of Dina de Malchuta Dina. So they say that it doesn't fall under the case of kibush, it doesn't fall under the case of conquest because it was a Hungarian unit that was doing this. And it doesn't fall under Dina Malchuta Dina because it's an illegal law, because it's discriminatory. So as a result, this property falls into this question of whether there was Yeush or not. And also another aspect, which we don't have time to get into, but we've spoken about before, to the question of Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. Even if there was Yeush, so then Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, it should be returned or not returned. So that has a slight difference in between when the Lifnim Mishurat Hadin, the application to cases of lost property as opposed to the case of stolen property, but I don't have time to get into that right now. But that's the last page of the Makorot, if you were interested in taking a look at it. Based on all of this, the final conclusion in this particular case was that, and this is source 22, he says, in this particular case, this is a situation where the Lifnim Mishurat Hadin would apply, and gam benidon didan nichla ba'otah takana shetiknu lahachzir lebal hachefetz kishebal yado misibat gezeila v'shod. So now this falls under that Mishnah in Bava Kama Daf Kuf Yudalet, that I am able to identify stolen property in the hand of other people, afilu achareshinit yashua ba'alim mehem, even if the original owners had never expected to see it again, I, the owner, have the right to claim it, and based on that, I would have to pay the current owner's compensation. However, there was no compensation ordered by the court here, and it gives two reasons. One was that it was clear that the organization that had given it to this institution, in this case it was the joint, had in their bylaws, they were looking for the original owners. They were only giving it over to the other institutions, because they didn't find the original owners. So the Beit Din felt that 2-year period or 3-year period or whatever it was before they gave it to other institutions didn't necessarily remove the original claim of the owner, and also they felt that so based on that you don't even need Lifnim Mishurat Hadin. You would say that it belongs to the original owners based on the halakha itself, and also in terms of the claim. Here, the institution hadn't actually had any out-of-pocket expense. They didn't purchase the keter. They were given the keter. They claimed that they had incurred expenses in order to receive it, which the court felt was far less than the amount that they were asking for. And in any event, they had used this Torah crown for the last 3-4 years, which they felt that in of itself was compensation enough. They've already used it, they've already received value, they're not being asked to pay the owner for their use of the property, so they should just be happy and give it over, and that was the original Psak Halacha. But here, I just wanted to give you an example, and I could give many other examples, of where the halachot that we're learning now, in terms of how to define Yeush, when is Yeush necessary, when is Yeush not necessary, Zutul Shel Yam, do you apply Zutul Shel Yam, do you not apply Zutul Shel Yam, this additional halacha that we mentioned in terms of the Kinyan Kibush, this really, when you think about it, a radical idea, but already found in the Gemara that war is a legal vehicle, and the results of war also affect property, and the halacha takes that into account, and how that works for the individual original owner, that of course it depends on each and every case. So we'll have mincha now. Any questions? Please come forward.